Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder in December said that lawmakers were at a loss when it comes to the Ohio death penalty. The state can't get the drugs needed to carry out the sentences, so what does it matter? The state hasn't carried out a death sentence in 18 months. The next one is scheduled for March, but most people agree it's unlikely that one will be carried out at that time either. We're talking about the uncertain future of capital punishment in Ohio. Karen Kassler is Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And Doug Berman, a law professor at Ohio State University, covers this issue. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
So Abe Bonowitz, he's the co-director of the nonprofit Death Penalty Action. It's a group opposed to the death penalty. And in October, they said they had some prominent anti-death penalty people in the state on a tour around the country. They said that 2019 was especially important for death penalty opponents because it was the first time supporters believed that they had an opportunity to change the state's laws on capital punishment. And I'm wondering, Karen, what do you think? What was the magic about 2019?
Well, I think you're seeing a couple things come together here. You've got Governor Mike DeWine, who has said, very clearly said back in February of last year, that he didn't feel that there was going to be an execution on his watch without some sort of federal court approval, looking it over and making sure everything was okay. But also, there was some real concern about the drugs that are used, the protocol that's used. Right now, the lethal injection is the only method by which inmates can be executed in Ohio. And that law changed back in the, 90s, maybe 80s. Mm-hmm. But so that's the only method. DeWine has said several times that the state has had trouble getting those execution drugs. Ohio's not the only state that's had this trouble.
Right.
But he is unwilling to put the state at risk, he says, for acquiring drugs for Medicaid, for prisons, that sort of thing, by going to those pharmaceutical companies and asking them for execution drugs, since many of those companies don't want their drugs to be used that way. So he says, you know, he's in kind of a situation where there is no way to do lethal injection in Ohio because the drugs are unavailable and changing the protocol doesn't seem to be happening. And it's the only way we can do this is lethal injection. So he's kind of kicked it back to state lawmakers and said, if we want to go through with this, you folks have to figure out some other way to do this.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the future of the death penalty in the state of Ohio. My guest, Karen Kassler, Bureau Chief for Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Also with us, Douglas Berman. He's a law professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law and specializes in this issue. If you have a question or comment coming up, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It was kind of rhetorical in the 90s during the Taft administration when they made lethal injection the sole option. There was an inmate at the time, a death row inmate, who had threatened to or wanted to use another method. I think it was the electric chair was still an option at that time. They wanted to eliminate that option. So that's when that happened. But the drug issue came up probably in the last 10 years now it's been an issue.
Well, and Ohio has had a couple of problematic executions where the Dennis McGuire back in 2014, that was the longest execution on record, I think, and there were some real concerns
about.
Meaning
it took several minutes.
Yes. I want to say 20-some minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then there was some real concern whether he suffered during that time. The Prisons Department says they did a review and that they don't feel he did, but there are some real questions about that particular protocol. They changed the protocol. They've changed the protocol several times. And now they've got a protocol that is being used in other states. But again, when you've got the governor saying he doesn't want to risk Ohio's ability to get drugs for the programs that it runs.
Because the pharmaceutical companies say that they will withdraw access if they use the drugs to kill people.
Yeah. And so because he's not willing to do that, he says it's pretty much up to the legislature right now that if you want to continue using the death penalty in Ohio, then there has to be potentially a change in the law that would allow for some other method. And you know, when I talk to for our TV show, The State of Ohio, I talked to Lou Tobin from the Prosecuting Attorneys Association, who said that there are some other options that the state could be looking at. I think nitrogen gas and compounding pharmacies. We tried that a couple years ago, where there would be this option where a pharmacy could create the drug, and then that pharmacy would be shielded from public records that they had created the drug, so that that pharmacy could not get any sort of blowback from public concern about that. But no pharmacies stepped forward to actually make those drugs.
Douglas Berman, the idea of cruel and unusual punishment has kind of been a moving target in the history of this country, right?
That's certainly right. And that's what sort of, you know, casts this constitutional shadow over all of these discussions. And I think probably without much disagreement, the Supreme Court has fairly clearly said the Eighth Amendment prohibits torture as a form of punishment. And that converts in this setting to a set of rulings that say a state can't use an execution method that would cause unnecessary pain, right? Because that would be torture in a sense if you're executing somebody in a way that's intentionally or designed to be painful in addition to just ending a person's life.
But that's designed to be. What if it's just we're doing the best we can?
Well, that's where all this litigation plays out, where the states, and it's not just Ohio, a number of other states say we're doing the best we can. And not surprisingly, representatives for the defendant says, no, you're not. We have a suggestion of how you could do better. Right. And in fact, this has made it all the way up to the Supreme Court twice, where the argument became, and a conservative Supreme Court said, before a defendant can block an execution method, they actually have to suggest something they believe would be less painful than the kind of good enough for government work that the state is trying out. And so that's become the sort of source of contention here. And here's what's interesting about what's played out in Ohio. After that ruling, a case called Glossop, the lower courts in Ohio, the federal court, said, you know, we actually think this might be close to torturous, these drugs, or at least there's some evidence to suggest it might not work well. But we're not sure that there's been a good showing that there's something better. So I guess you are allowed to go forward, Ohio. And I actually thought maybe Ohio would at that point. But that's when Governor DeWine stepped in and said, no, I'm not comfortable when we have a federal court saying this might be close to torture, but we're still going to go forward because we can't figure out what's better. And that's where, again, you know, Lou Tobin and others are saying, well, there are possibly better options. The nitrogen gas is kind of a popular one that's talked about a lot for states. Oklahoma's trying it out. The problem is everybody knows, and this would be true in Ohio too, once that was officially adopted, there would be robust litigation over that because the question would be, can we be confident that will work? Do we really know that that doesn't cause pain, even though there's some scientific basis for hoping it wouldn't? And so, you know, we're
and would the nitrogen gas suppliers say we don't want to provide the nitrogen gas?
Well, that's kind of easy. That's around everywhere, and that's one of the arguments that's often made why we ought to go that direction. But again, it's going to be up to the legislature to do that, and so far they haven't shown much interest in doing so.
Karen, has anyone or any do we know of any state that's called the pharmaceuticals bluff on this?
I don't think so, but
because that would be a lot of business to lose for the pharmaceutical companies.
But certainly, pharmaceutical companies will say that they're in the business of helping people, not killing people, and so that they're very concerned that their drugs might be used this way. But like Lou Tobin from the Prosecuting Attorneys Association pointed out, that other states are using the same protocol that Ohio uses, so they're getting the drugs somehow. So he was suggesting to me that maybe Ohio could reach out to those other states, reach out to the federal government, and find out where can we acquire these drugs so we can carry out these executions? Because we have, I think, six or seven that are scheduled for this year, including the first one starting in March, or the first one in March. And I think there's one in April and May and June and July.
They're all stacking up like cordwood over there. Yeah.
But, you know, as of right now, I think it's very likely that DeWine is going to delay those executions because, again, there's no way to carry out those executions without the drugs in the state.
There are fewer. The rate at which we're accumulating, though, or adding to the death row ranks is slowed demonstrably, right?
Yes, it has. But Cuyahoga County is leading the nation in terms of death sentences handed out. I think over the last 2 years, they did 8.
Beating out Hamilton now.
Yeah, beating out everybody in the nation, leading the nation.
Really?
So, and Lou Tobin has pointed out that, you know, Cuyahoga County has had a lot of murders. And so to only have 8 death sentences handed down with several hundred murders that have happened, that is showing that the prosecuting attorney's office there is using the death penalty as it should be. But of course, the argument could be made, why hand out a death sentence if nobody is going to be executed? I mean, I think we have about 144 people on death row right now, and a lot of them are getting older, and so that's
More expensive.
They're getting older. They're dying. They're more expensive, and so I think that's one reason why you're seeing fewer executions because of that. But also, there are fewer death sentences, I think, overall being handed down across the country. I think there were 22 last year, I think, overall.
And so when we talk about these 8 cases that are ready to go, that means the appeals have run out.
No, I think these are Cuyahoga County cases.
There's
certainly been really dozens in Ohio that have gone through all of the appeals. That's why actually another thing that made Ohio unique is we had a habit of setting execution dates literally years in advance. So we had the longest kind of queue for executions of any state in the nation. Other states tend to just do it, 3 months in advance. We literally have had execution dates scheduled out, I think, to 2024 right now. And part of the theory is it's good to let people know for their appeals if they're going to, even if their regular appeals have run their course, there's always new arguments. There's always new questions about execution dates. In fact, there have been litigation over when you can litigate over the execution method. And there were some, from the defense perspective, And there have been some rulings that said, oh, well, Ohio changed to lethal injection in 1991 and you didn't bring a challenge then. So now in 2010, you can't complain about it. And the defense says, well, but they changed how they executed, the drugs they were using, or whether it's one drug or three drug. And they're like, sorry, still the same method, sort of. So you should have brought this charge back. There's all sorts of disputes even about when and how and where you can challenge a tweaked execution method. And so, again, that's where, lawyers can and do fight over this. And because it's literally a matter of life and death, there will always be defense attorneys who will argue, rightly so, every point. I just want to, highlight in part because some of my former students do the work. We have here in Ohio some of the really best death row defense attorneys who have been particularly effective at highlighting flaws in every aspect of the way in which lethal injection has been done. And as Karen mentioned earlier, we've had some botched executions. All of that adds up to, I think, not just the courts being inclined to scrutinize any change, but also Governor DeWine recognizing there's always going to be litigation challenges here that could slow things down no matter what we try to do going forward.
The way the states operate and litigate these cases, do they operate in silos still at this point?
Oh, I don't know what you mean by silos, but there's so many different courts.
Because there's state laws.
Well, there's state law challenges, and so whether Ohio is following its own rules and procedures is one basis to attack what's getting done or what's getting changed. But then, as we mentioned before, you have the Eighth Amendment constitutional rules that you can bring in federal court, that you, even if you lose in state court, can say, hey, federal court, the state court didn't get it right. And so there's always going to be new avenues for bringing these appeals.
And of course, everybody has as their last avenue the governor. And so about a month before a person's execution date, there'll be a clemency hearing. And that is an opportunity for both sides to once again restate their cases on why this person should be executed or not. And then that information is transmitted to the governor. He has the parole board makes a recommendation whether this person should get clemency or not. And the governor can either take that recommendation or do what he wants. And we saw several—actually, what's interesting is Democratic Governor Ted Strickland, who was a prison psychologist, had the most executions during his 4-year term of any recent governor.
Right.
And since then, John Kasich was there for 8 years. He had fewer. He commuted to life without parole, more sentences. And now you've got DeWine, who I don't think has commuted anybody's sentence to life without parole, but has delayed executions.
Indefinitely. Before I let you go, Karen, what is the likelihood that the Ohio General Assembly is actually going to take this issue up? We have obviously the Speaker of the House saying that they're kind of at a loggerheads over it, but that doesn't mean anything. They're at a loggerheads on a million things. So is anything going to change?
Well, I think, the question is whether it's a priority among lawmakers to actually actually look at this and to think about the number of executions that are in the queue and figure out what can be done. Because, like Doug's saying, as soon as you change the process, that starts the legal fighting over it. So if you're going to change the law now, it's going to be years probably before that could potentially be used in an execution. I think, though, you know, on the TV show The State of Ohio, I talked to Justice Paul Pfeiffer, former Supreme Court Justice.
And the author of the original death penalty bill, right?
Who now says, he wrote an article for the Ohio State Criminal Law Journal about the journey of the death penalty law and says he always had some reservations, but now he has serious reservations about how the law is being used. And he's the one that said he doesn't think there's going to be another execution. And he says, though, he doubts the state will go the step of removing it from the books, repealing it. But he thinks we're kind of going to be in this limbo period like California is, where it is the law and prosecutors do use it for plea bargaining and that sort of thing, but it's really not going to be carried out. That there's basically a moratorium, though not in law, but in practice.
And so then where are the rights of the victims' families and that kind of a thing? Is that an issue?
They're stuck in limbo, right? Yeah. You know, and that's one of the things that's of ongoing concern. Although, again, as the death penalty has played out over recent decades, that's often been a point that's made by death penalty abolitionists saying, look, no matter how you try to run your death penalty, there are going to be delays, there are going to be mistakes. It's going to be an agonizing process for victims. The better way to seek closure, get life without the possibility of parole, make it done that way. That's the best way to do it. And there are victims groups that are out there advocating for abolition of the death penalty, you know, sort of emphasizing that point. That may be right going forward for victims who either wanted or relied on a death sentence in the past. They are stuck. Although, in as Karen mentions, you know, one of the things that can be so powerful is if over time they say, this isn't worth it, I'm done, they can advocate to the governor, to the parole board, go ahead and commute this sentence to life without parole. I don't want to go up and down every time an execution date is set to even have to agonize over these issues.
They don't actually have legal standing, though, to do that. That's just something that the governor takes into consideration.
Yes, although after Marcy's law, there's debate over whether or not victims have more legal rights to have direct involvement. Again, whether it's formal or not, rightly so, the voice of victims and their families in every criminal setting always has an extra salience. And in this setting, particularly when often it's decades since the crime took place, whether they've been able to move on or haven't can really influence all the players involved.
Karen Kassler, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time, as always.
Thank you so much.
We'll return with Doug Berman, law professor at Ohio State University, to talk about the rules and regulations and the possible future of the death penalty. Also joining us will be the executive director of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association. So stay with us. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder in December said that state lawmakers were kind of at a crossroads on the death penalty. If the state can't get the proper drugs to carry out a lethal injection, why have the punishment? Governor, Mike DeWine, has sort of kicked it into their court. He's not scheduling any executions for now. One is technically scheduled for March, but it'll probably go the way of the last half dozen or so and be put on indefinite hold. Still with us is OSU Law Professor Douglas Berman. Louis Tobin is the executive director of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association, which has cautioned against repealing the law in Ohio. Welcome back, Lou.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
In November, for the first time in 34 years, the Gallup has polled the question. A majority of Americans said life without the possibility of parole was a better punishment for murder than the death penalty. But it's mushy. I mean, NPR did another poll that said that it's much closer than that. And also people change their attitude about the death penalty when it's contrasted with something like life without parole. So, Lou, what's the difference when it comes to the bargaining chip value of a sentence? What's the difference between life without parole and the death penalty?
Well, I think a couple of things. You know, I think it's important to not have conversations about the death penalty in a vacuum and just say and just ask people whether they prefer life without parole over the death penalty without considering some of the heinous things that people on death row have done. You know, all murder is heinous, but unfortunately there are degrees of heinousness even. And so, you know, we're talking about people that have committed 3 murders or 5 murders or 11 murders, who have murdered children, who have murdered witnesses in hopes of avoiding prosecution. So, you know, it's important to not have these conversations in a vacuum and to understand exactly why some people are sentenced to death in this state. And I think as far as polling goes, I think you're right that most people do prefer life without parole when we talk about things in a vacuum. But I saw an NPR, PBS, Marist poll over the summer that showed overwhelming support for the death penalty, you know, across the board and across socioeconomic factors. You know, I don't think that prosecutors really use the death penalty as a bargaining chip. I think sometimes it does result in someone pleading to life without parole. But I think most of the time prosecutors use the death penalty because they feel like a certain case demands it and that, you know, justice demands it.
Is there any sort of rule or regulation that says prosecutors must do it, use it for that purpose?
No, it's all of this is within the prosecutor's discretion.
Right.
Obviously, they have to look at the statutory factors and make sure that the person falls within the statute. And I think most prosecutors these days, if not all prosecutors, even go beyond that. And, you know, prosecutors worry about residual doubt, too. So they want to be sure, first of all, that this person committed this crime. And second of all, you know, I think they take considerations like the strength of the case, the justice of the case, the credibility and availability of the witnesses, and even mitigating factors for the defendant into consideration before they're seeking a death sentence.
Is that a function of revelations of innocence for people that have been sitting on death row or, you know, also in prison without parole or for many years?
I don't know. You know, I think there are probably a variety of factors that play into it. You know, I think the way that the death penalty is used today, there is practically no possibility that the person is going to be innocent. You know, there's appeal after appeal after appeal and safeguard after safeguard to make sure that that doesn't happen. I think, you know, prosecutors are maybe reluctant to seek the death penalty in some cases where they used to seek it just because of all the obstacles that there are to it. So they want to be sure that the death penalty is what justice demands.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the future of the death penalty in Ohio. House Speaker Larry Householder in December said that he didn't know what the future held because it is so hard to get the drugs that are necessary to carry out lethal injection, which is the only option in the state of Ohio since 1991. You just heard Lewis Tobin. He's the executive director of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association, which has cautioned against any repeal of the death penalty. Also with us, Ohio State University law professor Douglas Berman. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Jim in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hello. One of the things that always, I guess, fascinates me is why doesn't Ohio just choose the drugs that all of the addicts are dying on, which would be heroin or fentanyl, and to make it less painful, perhaps Valium and alcohol. That combination is absolutely works, and apparently it doesn't cause that much pain because addicts are dying all the time from it.
Doug Berman, what about that? I mean, that question comes up pretty routinely when we're talking about this issue.
Yeah, there's been a lot of suggestions to turn to fentanyl and opioids, and one reality is at least one state has tried that and seemed to be successful. And so it's a possibility as an alternative drug. The concern that Governor DeWine has expressed that using a medical drug for executions could lead to these sort of echo effects into our healthcare system, right? Fentanyl is still widely used, as a pain reliever in a variety of settings. If done medically appropriately, there aren't problems. It's an effective pain relief. That's why it was created. And so the concern is, if the state were to start using fentanyl or other opioids as a way to kill those on death row, it would send an echo through our healthcare system, might lead to some suppliers be unwilling to provide it to hospitals or in other medical settings.
The same problem we're having with the drugs now.
And there's also the flip of it is, you're giving me the drugs, says a patient in a hospital that's being used to kill somebody next week. I don't want that opioid. That sounds dangerous to me. Hmm. You create sort of a different kind of echoes through healthcare concerns. And so I think that's one of the reservations to making that turn, even though, again, it seems sort of in a common sense way, gosh, a lot of people are dying from this. Why can't we try that approach?
So, Lou Tobin, if there's a genuine belief among some prosecutors, if not most, that the death penalty should be an option, and the option is untenable at this point, the only option, what do you recommend?
Yeah, so I think Jim raises a good point that what we have, and Doug too, what we have isn't set in stone. I think there are ways forward. In 2019, there were 22 executions in 7 other states. 2 of those states used the protocol that Ohio currently has. It starts with midazolam. 4 of those states used the protocol that Ohio used to have that uses phenobarbital. So other states have the drugs. They're finding the drugs. I think a good place to start would be contacting them and seeing if they'd either be willing to sell some drugs to Ohio or tell us how they're acquiring the drugs. And we could do the same thing with the federal government. I think another important step for the legislature would be to reenact the confidentiality statute that we had in place until, I think, March 2017. That statute provided confidentiality for drug manufacturers and drug compounding entities who decided to sell Ohio the drugs. I think we can't say, well, nobody's willing to give us the drugs before we provide them with the confidentiality and see if that changes the equation. I think the legislature should also consider amending the statute to provide, in addition to lethal injection, for any other constitutionally permissible method of execution. And I think we need to explore the use of nitrogen gas, which Oklahoma is exploring right now, and I think Alabama and Mississippi are as well.
As far as the confidentiality, are you talking about for the compound pharmacies?
Yes.
I thought that they did offer confidentiality in the past, and none came forward.
I heard Karen say that, and that may be true, but I don't think we can say that they're not willing to sell us the drugs until we put that back in place and see if it changes things. We should be reluctant to say, well, we can't get the drugs, so we have to repeal the statute without trying other alternatives first.
And Doug Berman, the argument against, is there an argument against confidentiality?
Oh, absolutely. The defense says we need to know where these drugs are coming from. And there's actually a considerable media evidence of finding drugs being bought out of literally a van in India to be able to use in a state because it's so challenging in the United States to find a manufacturer who's willing to provide this. And again, both sides use that as an argument. See, you've litigated against this so aggressively that we can't get a reasonable supply of the drugs, so we have to turn to compounding pharmacies or entities, in other countries. Mm. But the death row defendants say through their lawyers, you're going to kill us with this. We need to know what's in there. How can we protect our clients from the possibility of unnecessary pain if you're literally buying the drugs off the back of a truck and you're not telling us what's in there and who provided it, right? And so their argument is confidentiality is all well and good if we can trust the source that's providing these drugs that are going to be killing our clients, but there's no basis for having that trust, and until we can verify, we're not going to trust.
Lou Tobin, it seems like an odd issue for prosecutors to have to get involved in the method of execution. It's not exactly their job, right?
Right.
So how do prosecutors, what do your members say about the state getting the drugs secretly, the state getting the drugs? I don't like to use shaky, in a shaky way.
Well,
or dicey.
Well, you know, I don't know that that's necessarily the case. You know, I think the purpose of confidentiality would be to approach legitimate pharmacies and see if they would now be willing to provide us the drugs if we were willing to keep that information confidential. You know, I think prosecutors are... Yes, but, you know, it's not our job to worry about the method of execution, but it is our job to make sure that lawfully imposed sentences are carried out. And right now, you know, all of the people whose executions were delayed last year have exhausted their appeals. They're sitting there with a lawfully imposed death sentence, and we're not following through with that lawfully imposed sentence. So I think that's frustrating to prosecutors, and what we want to do is find a way forward.
And is there any argument? You know, I'll turn to Doug first, but I'm certainly interested in what you think, Lou, is as far as cruel and unusual punishment or the having somebody sit on death row, not knowing if they'll die there or not by natural causes.
So Justice Breyer on the U.S. Supreme Court is incredibly happy you asked that question, okay, because he's been arguing literally almost from the time he got to the court that extended delays is itself a form of cruel and unusual punishment. He's actually piggybacking off of arguments that had been made by late Justice Stevens as well. And that's never gotten a majority of the Supreme Court. In fact, it's never gotten more than one or two votes. Often the pushback is, hey, it's taken so long because you, the defendant, have been arguing against the imposition of the punishment for so long, you shouldn't be able to kind of, you know, win by attrition. But it really depends.
But now it's taking so long at this point because they can't figure out how to do it.
That's exactly right. And in fact, often defendants will say in these settings, hey, I brought my legal claim within 6 months or a year like I had to. It took the courts 5 years, 10 years. It took, you know, the prison officials so long to figure out a way to do it. I definitely think there's a chance. I don't want to say a likelihood, but a chance. Maybe not the U.S. Supreme Court, but maybe the Ohio Supreme Court would become the ultimate sort of resolver of this stalemate by fundamentally saying, look, state of Ohio, you've gone years, I'm imagining maybe 5-10 years from now, without moving this forward. At some point, we're saying enough is enough, right? And I'm not predicting that's what's going to happen. I don't think the current members of the Ohio Supreme Court would go that way. But that argument not only has been kind of widely discussed, but there are historically at least a few Supreme Court justices that think that should be a winning argument to allow somebody to get off death row after a certain extended period.
What do you think, Lou Tobin, and what do you also about what about the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association's views on, the Governor Kasich, the last governor, commuting sentences to life without parole?
Well, first of all, I think undue delay, as Doug notes, is a real problem. I think prosecutors would be much more interested in finding ways to reduce undue delay than continually putting up more barriers to lawfully imposed sentences and barriers that are never going to make death penalty opponents happy anyway. You know, death penalty opponents want two things. They want, first of all, repeal, and second of all, barring repeal, they want to put up so many obstacles to imposing a death sentence that we're having the conversation that we're having now. Mm-hmm. Undue delay is a real problem. And I guess I'll just leave it at that.
And then about commuting sentences to life without parole, did the Prosecuting Attorneys Association voice any opinion on that when Governor Kasich did that?
No, we didn't. I think it's
his right, but you know,
it's the governor's prerogative to make decisions like that. I think it's always of concern to the prosecutors when we're undoing lawfully imposed sentences. You know, these are people that have been indicted by a grand jury. They've been found guilty by a trial jury. They've gone through a second sentencing phase with a trial jury, and then they've been sentenced to death by a judge and then gone through multiple layers of appeal. So I think it is concerning when we undo lawfully imposed sentences.
Well, Louis Tobin, thank you so much for your time today. As always, I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Happy to be here.
Louis Tobin, Executive Director of the Ohio Prosecuting Attorneys Association. We're going to continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment about the uncertainty regarding the death penalty in Ohio, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the uncertain future for the death penalty in Ohio. Still with us is Ohio State University law professor Douglas Berman. Robert Dunham is the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I wanted to talk more about that, the localization of the death penalty, how it's used differently in different places or not at all for reasons that have nothing to do with the guilt or the heinousness of the crime. It has to do with the pocketbook of the county and whether that becomes an issue going forward.
Well, I think certainly the pocketbook of the county has an effect. But beyond that, it's the politics of the prosecutor. We did a study in 2013, which we're going to update this year, that showed that 85% of the counties in the United States don't have anybody on death row. And that fewer than 2% of the counties account for more than half of everybody who's on death row. Ohio is a perfect example of this. Hamilton County and Cuyahoga County are two counties that have disproportionate numbers of people on death row. And in Cuyahoga County, more people have been sentenced to death in the last 2 years than in any other county in the United States, not because crime is going up there, but because the chief prosecutor changed.
Right. They have it's the discretion of the prosecutor at this point.
That's right. There's no such thing as a mandatory death penalty. So prosecutors have discretion to decide when and if they're going to seek the death penalty. Most prosecutors in most counties don't do it. Some of that is for financial reasons, but most of it is political judgments. And what we saw in Cuyahoga County is that in the 5 years before the current district attorney, state attorney, Michael O'Malley was elected, in those 5 years, there was one death sentence. In the last 2 years, there have been five.
Is there what's your observation of that, Douglas Berman? And you and I were talking off the air, and I'd like you to tell us the contrast Cuyahoga with Hamilton and how they go about it. Contrast Michael O'Malley with Joe Dieters.
Well, I think there are so many factors that go into prosecutorial discretion. At the end of the day, what's so some might say problematic, others would say American about the death penalty system is even though each state individually decides whether to have a death penalty, how that gets applied is a county by county story. And again, Robert and his organization have done incredible work just sort of highlighting how disparate that can be across counties. But that difference isn't always simply a matter of, the voters here want the death penalty and the voters there don't. It can also be a function of how different prosecutors think the death penalty should function. So here in Ohio, you know, mentioning Cuyahoga and Hamilton County, you know, I served on the Supreme Court's task force looking at the administration of the death penalty in the state some years ago. And we heard from Joe Dieters, the Hamilton County prosecutor, who said, I do an incredible amount of work on the front end to decide whether I think a case really should involve the death penalty before I even indict it as a capital case. But once I do, don't try to plea bargain with me. I'm not going to come off that judgment. At that point, once I've decided this is properly a capital case, I think it's the jury's role. The jury has discretion at the end of the process after a conviction to decide on life or death. I'm leaving that to the jury. I'm going to stick with this as a death case once I've made that judgment on the front end. And so the number of indictments from Hamilton County, capital indictments, relatively low, but the number of death sentences that resulted, relatively high. Contrast Cuyahoga County, where for a previous prosecutor basically indicted every eligible murder as a capital case, but plea bargained almost every single one of those. And so if you looked at how many cases were indicted as a death case in Cuyahoga County, so many more than Hamilton County, but many fewer death sentences because the prosecutor was comfortable. Some would complain, maybe too eager to use the death penalty as a bargaining chip rather than as really a basis to move forward with a proper punishment. And that's not even really politics. It's about kind of a combination of a philosophy of using the death penalty and prosecutorial prerogative.
I'm going to bring in Kevin now. Kevin in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Ann. Thanks so much for taking the call.
Sure.
I just want to mention Mr. Tobin, who was on just a short while ago with the Prosecuting Attorneys Association, sort of said that, you know, he didn't think it's really possible for there to be an innocent person on death row because of the way the system works now. And I just have to point out that, and I think your guests can sort of speak a little bit more to this, but essentially, for every 10 executions that have happened across the country, one person has been exonerated. And in Ohio, those numbers are far worse. For every 6 executions we have conducted, we have let someone go because we got the wrong person. And so what really is happening is that prosecutors, when they get into post-conviction, prosecutors are fighting to uphold the convictions at any cost instead of seeking the truth. And so if the Prosecuting Attorneys Association is really serious about ensuring that there are no innocent people on death row, then what they ought to do is seek policy changes that would incorporate conviction integrity units across the state and not work to uphold the convictions at any cost.
Oh, that's been I appreciate that. There was some good work done on that issue, I think, in the New York Times recently. What do you think, Robert Dunham, about that?
Well, I think it's laughable to assert that there's nobody who is innocent who is being sentenced to death. In fact, last year, as our year-end report indicated, there were 2 people who were likely innocent who were executed, and there are a number of others who came very, very close to being executed. There were also 3 more exonerations, bringing the total to 167 of documented exonerations of people wrongly convicted and sentenced to death who were later freed. And I think that you have to be an ardent innocence denier to say that there aren't innocent people who are going to death row. The biggest problem that we see with the innocence cases is prosecutorial and police misconduct, and it's understandable why some prosecutors would want to deny the possibility that innocent people are being sentenced to death when the single most prevalent cause of those wrongful convictions is official misconduct. But the obligation of a prosecutor is to do justice, not to secure a conviction. And the obligation of the prosecutor is to do justice, not to obtain an execution at any cost. I think that the kind of obstructionism that we often see towards getting at the truth is one of the reasons why public support for the death penalty has been declining so much over the course of the last 20 years, because the public is no longer able to assume that we can trust the government to carry this out properly and that government officials really want it to be carried out properly.
What do you think, Doug Berman? I mean, what's the tipping point issue?
I'm rarely inclined to be the one to defend prosecutors, but here I'll at least say I think what Lou Tobin was trying to suggest is these days he's confident that there's no risk of an innocent person being sent to death row because of the range of safeguards we have in place. I think the caller and Robert's right to say that requires a particular kind of faith in the system that hasn't been borne out in decades past, and I think fundamentally what capital cases highlight at the most extreme level is a society's desire to blame somebody when there's a terrible crime and the inevitability. There's a lot of psychological research to support that a certain kind of tunnel vision gets locked in place. Once you think this is the person who's responsible for that terrible crime, you start seeing all the evidence, you start seeing any doubt.
In terms of that.
And so I think that's where, again, you know, the suggestion like a conviction integrity unit where there's somebody whose job it is distinct from the prosecutor to ask those questions, to look into doubts about guilt, can give us even more faith that the system is going to function appropriately. And again, it's something that I think we're working on, not just in the capital setting, but in other cases as well. That's a really important move, as we've discovered, DNA evidence and other kinds of forensics have highlighted, that our system hasn't been nearly as accurate and predictable as we want it to be. And I think there's reason to be fearful if Lou Tobin's coming on and saying, well, now we've got it right. We still should be skeptical of any claims that we've got it perfect now, when it's so clear we didn't have it perfect before.
And could it, Robert Dunham, could it be that it's not outright innocence, but that what tipped it into a capital punishment category is something that could be disputed and overturned down the line? We're not always talking about outright innocence, but it's the details, the devil's in the details, and it could be something that if something's overturned, some evidence is overturned down the line, it would at least take someone out of the category of capital punishment.
Yes, that's certainly the case. And in fact, nationwide, when we take a look at who's been sentenced to death since the death penalty came back in the 1970s, we've identified approximately 9,400 death sentences that have been imposed since the death penalty came back in the United States. The single most likely outcome once somebody is sentenced to death isn't that they get executed, isn't that they get found innocent. It's that the conviction or death sentence gets overturned for some other reason. Mostly, the most prevalent reason for that is ineffective representation, because states and counties have, through the course of the last 40 years, failed to provide the level of representation that you would want in a capital case. But there are also problems with bad evidence, with bad jury instructions, new evidence being discovered. So I think that you're right. The innocence cases get a lot of attention, but there are very serious problems throughout the course of capital proceedings. And that's one of the things that the Ohio Task Force, that Professor Berman served on, noticed. And they recommended 56 different types of reforms that should be brought about. And I think that we need to be paying very serious attention to those kinds of reforms, not just in Ohio, but across the country.
56 reforms. How many of those were embraced?
I think about a handful. And so there's still a lot more work to do, although, you know, a variety of them, you know, are controversial. And there have been at least efforts to move forward with bills. Again, there's the prosecutors who are serving on that task force issued a dissenting report essentially saying if we were to impose all of the recommendations and put them all in place, we'd functionally abolish the death penalty because we'd be putting up so many standards of proof and you know, safeguards against wrongful convictions. But of course, that's what other people would say, exactly right. If you can't do this without the gold standard approach to the evidence and the way in which the death sentence is imposed, you shouldn't be doing it at all.
You know, there's lots of reasons people give for opposing the death penalty. There's the moral component, the moral issue. There's the fear of mistakes have been made. And Robert Dunham, there's also the cost issue. That's why even fiscal conservatives that otherwise embrace the death penalty are starting to say this is just costing too much stinking money. What do we know about how do we crunch those numbers? What do we know about what the death penalty costs us in the United States or even in Ohio?
Well, the death penalty, what we do know is that wherever there is a death penalty, it costs more than the system that doesn't have it. The numbers are different in every state because different states have different approaches to capital punishment. They have different levels of indigent defense. They have different appellate systems. But what's clear is that it costs states millions of dollars extra each year when they have capital punishment. And people, you know, they think, well, wait a minute. It doesn't really cost that much to carry out an execution. But the cost of the death penalty is not the cost of an execution by itself. It's the cost of all the cases that are capitally pursued that result in life sentences or less. It's the cost of all the capital cases that are in which death sentences are imposed but are overturned. It's the opportunity costs as well, the other kinds of cases that you don't get to move through the courts because of the immense number of resources that are absorbed by capital cases. And what I thought was very, very interesting, we began to see a shift in conservative public opinion about the death penalty at about the time of the Great Recession. Hmm. Because before then, when governments had sufficient money to do what they wanted, you could have an ideological approach divorced from the practical realities. But once the resources that were necessary for criminal justice in general to pay for schools, to pay for healthcare, and so forth became much more difficult to obtain, we saw conservatives beginning to subject the death penalty to a cost-effectiveness analysis. And they found, one, it does cost more. So can we justify it? And again, with the single most likely outcome of a capital case being that the conviction or death sentence will be overturned, and with the huge risk of executing somebody who's innocent, they said it's not cost effective. It may not be worth that risk.
Robert Dunham, Executive Director for the Death Penalty Information Center, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Douglas Berman, law professor at Ohio State University. Thanks, as always, for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Ann. Appreciate it, too.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.